Every Word Matters. I'm George Walther, and I'll be your host in this segment of a series that's based on the notion that every word and phrase you use contributes significantly to your success or failure in any life endeavor. When things go well, successful people identify what steps they took to create that success, and they give themselves credit for it so they can repeat it and do it again. They also use an explanatory style which shows others and themselves that each success in life is a part of what they perceive to be a continuing trend. In this segment, we're going to talk about situations that don't always go so well. In fact, you might say that the greatest difference between people who experience tremendous success and those who fall far short of their potential in lives has more to do with how they respond to losses than to wins. Winners in life actually experience more failures than losers do. That seems counterintuitive at first. But think about it. People who do not set high goals for themselves and do not set out to achieve great things, well, they don't achieve very much. They stick to the nice, safe, low-risk path. Winners are always trying something new. They're stretching. And those experiences don't always work out very well. It's how people react to those negative situations that in large part determines what the trajectory will be in their lives. To put it very succinctly, winners rebound resiliently. They bounce back. Of course things go wrong for them. In fact, more things go wrong for them then go wrong for losers. And when they go wrong, winners don't let those setbacks stop them. In fact, they view them as highly valuable learning opportunities. The most successful people I know can always tell detailed stories about some major turning point in their life that involved a significant setback. Maybe they got fired from their first job, or went through a painful divorce, or took a large financial gamble and lost. In my case, one of the most important lessons I've ever learned also came from something that didn't go quite the way I had planned. It took place on June 16, 1996. I have a private pilot's license, and I had donated a flight to a charity auction. It happened to be the Starlight Foundation, which aids critically ill kids. Now, as often happens with these charity auctions, you know, somebody puts the hit on you to donate prizes. And if you're a private pilot, somebody will definitely be calling you to say, "Hey, could you donate a sightseeing flight?" And I agreed to do so. Now, at the auction, the auctioneer said to the audience, "And this next item is a sightseeing flight to the San Juan Islands." And this is an area north and west of Seattle where I live. That's a very beautiful scenic area. And the bidding was active. One person, though, always outbid everybody else. It was clear that this guy was determined to be the winner. And indeed, he was, ultimately, the successful bidder. So after the auction, I got a call from somebody named Pete Buck. And he phoned up and identified himself as a local attorney in Seattle and said that he had been the winning bidder and he was intent on winning this particular prize because he had recently become engaged and had met his fiancée at a small airport, yacht harbor in the islands north and west of Seattle. They had a little airstrip next to it, and he had met her at the yacht club. So his idea was, "Ha, what if I had George fly me and my fiance up to that little airstrip?" And because he was an attorney, he said to me, "I want to return to the scene of the crime." So that was fine. June 16th was their anniversary, and so I said, "Okay, great. Meet me at the airport." I gave them directions how to reach my plane. And sure enough, they came striding across the asphalt. I could see there was quite a difference between these two because Pete, who had been doing the bidding, he was a mid-50s lawyer guy, very optimistic. You could see he had, you know, a spring in his step, little salt and pepper hair. He was eager. He was going to be flying, and he knew that he had a surprise in mind for his fiancée. Behind him came his fiancée, Jean. Jean was a little different. You could see her sort of slowly coming along, and you could tell she was not at all excited about this idea of climbing into a small plane. But still, I was determined that they were going to have a great flight. So I got them seated in the plane, and I took my seat. And, of course, as the captain, I'm always sitting in the left seat in the cockpit. And before takeoff, every pilot, private or commercial, you're required to give a safety announcement, a briefing to your passengers. And I could see that in the back seat, Gene was a little uptight. So I decided, well, I'll make it a little bit fun, you know, loosen it up a little. I said, now, Pete, in case we should land prematurely, you want to raise that lever so you can push open the door and get out of this cockpit. And Gene, don't you worry now. If I should slump forward at any point, don't worry. Pete can land the plane. He just has to press this red button, and the tower will hear him. He'll say, help, the pilot's dead. But Gene, be sure he releases the button. You've got to hear them. They'll talk him down. Everything will be fine. It was a perfect day. We took off. Of course, there's a checklist when you take off and a checklist when you land. I went through all of the items in my checklist. We took off. It was perfect weather. Put the plane on autopilot, and I was sort of narrating. Gene, up ahead there, see, that's Mount Baker. Look at all those glaciers. Behind you, that's Mount Rainier. Tremendous views today, completely clear. And as we approached our destination, I went through my pre-landing checklist, you know, fuel mixture rich, flaps 10 degrees, get the right radio frequency. And then there was something that was not on my checklist. I heard a voice. Don't land there. It's kind of weird, and I looked over at Pete and to see if he'd heard this. No reaction from him, so it was my private voice. I thought, that was kind of creepy. Don't land here? I checked my instruments. Everything was fine. The weather was perfect. So I proceeded in the pattern. And as a pilot, you don't just aim for the airport. You follow. You have a little book. You flip to the page for that particular airport, and it shows you a rectangular pattern. And so the last thing you do before landing is turn, in this case, from left base to final. And as I made that final turn, I heard it again. Don't land there. And for a minute, I just thought, gee, maybe I should change destinations. Maybe there are a lot of other airports in the area. I know he wants to land here because that's where he and Gene first met. He'd be disappointed. He'd think I'm afraid. I don't want him to think that. And then I thought, well, how would I say it anyway? You know, Pete, excuse me. I just want to let you know, don't worry, the gauges are fine, the weather's perfect, I feel wonderful, but I am hearing voices in my head. You don't want your pilot to come on and say, I'm hearing voices on final approach here. So I decided to ignore the voices, proceeded in for landing. Just before touchdown, we encountered a phenomenon that you encounter whenever you fly commercially, and it's called wind shear. Now, all pilots know what wind shear is. It's a vertical wind. You can't see it. There's nothing you can do to protect yourself from wind shear. And normally, it's really, hey, if you're at 33,000 feet and the plane drops 50 feet, your coffee jiggles a little bit. It happens to you on every flight. It's no big deal. Dropping 50 feet from 33,000, it's nothing. Of course, dropping 50 feet when you're only 33 feet off the ground, that's a big deal. And that's what happened to us. So here we are, of course, in the air, you're steering with a yoke. Once you're on the ground, when you're on a runway, hopefully, your yoke does nothing. You steer with your foot pedals. So suddenly, the plane was on the ground, still moving forward. I could see the runway less than 100 yards ahead. I think, okay, we're going to make it. We're going to make it. And I was steering with my feet, and the plane was bouncing around, and Pete was hanging on. Gene, of course, was thinking, I knew I shouldn't have gone on this plane. And we bumped over these small bumps and bushes and shrubs, still heading for the runway. And it's so weird what goes through your mind in emergency situations like that. I remember thinking, just three things. I thought, one, oh, fine, I'm going to get grass stains all over my plane now. No explaining why you think of things like this. And second, I thought, should have listened to that voice. And third, I thought, why did the winning bidder have to be an attorney? I don't want a lawyer on board when I'm crashing. But still, I kept the plane going straight, struggled with my foot pedals. And just as we reached the beginning of the runway, I saw the ditch. Nose gear of the plane dropped down in the ditch, sheared off the bottom of the plane, and in that particular plane, a Cessna 182, the carburetor is on the bottom of the engine block. Well, that sheared off right away. And as a conscientious pilot, I made sure that I had 55 gallons of fuel on board, which now started spilling out onto the runway. And as we slid down on our belly with sparks flying, well, you know what happened next. The plane came to a stop. The cockpit began to fill with smoke. Quickly, I got out of the plane. Pete fortunately followed his instructions and did exactly what he was supposed to do. And we stood back and watched as my Cessna 182 burned up. Want to see a picture? Yeah, you don't ever want to land in a plane that looks like that after the landing. Well, I'm very happy to tell you that none of us sustained any injury. Not a singed hair, no cut, nothing. We escaped scot-free. But I certainly felt like a failure. I mean, after all, the pilot is supposed to land the plane intact with everybody safe, and the plane is not supposed to burn up. But you know, as more I thought about failure, the more I thought about Henry Ford, who did a lot of failures in his time. The best comment I've ever heard about failure came from Henry Ford, who said, "Failure is the opportunity to begin again more intelligently." Whenever you experience a major setback in life, the most valuable thing you can do is step back and ask yourself, "What are the lessons that I learned from that experience that will help shape my future behavior?" Typically, those lessons will help you to ensure that you don't repeat the negative experience. So what's the lesson I learned from my fateful flight that day? Very simple. Listen to that inner voice. Now, I don't currently own an airplane, but I do ride motorcycles. And I have noticed, if I'm heading down the road, and I start getting this feeling like I ought to change lanes, I don't go through a big questioning process. You know, why would I be getting that funny thought? I wonder if there's any rational basis for it. I don't question it. I follow that voice. And by the way, almost always when I do change lanes, sure enough, I'll notice that a couple of car lengths ahead, maybe there's an old bashed up pickup truck driving along. And I think, okay, if the truck is dented, that means that driver has low spatial awareness. If he hits other things, he might have been hitting me. And the truck, maybe it's in bad repair. Probably that person is not very conscientious. Maybe they have a sheet of plywood in the back that's not tied down well. That's going to come flying up. In other words, there's a good reason for that voice. What I learned because of the plane crash is that you don't have to question the voice. Follow it. I now know that that plane crash was the result of my voice telling me I shouldn't land there. Maybe my eyes detected a certain bending on the top of the trees that indicated wind conditions were a little funny. Maybe it's that my voice was monitoring how I felt, and maybe I wasn't quite up to that challenging landing that day. Whatever it is, though, what I've extracted from it is the lesson. Listen to that voice. You get lessons from your setbacks, too. Here's a very simple word substitution that I will urge you to use whenever you encounter a setback. Rather than saying, "I failed," convert that to, "I learned," and capsulize the lesson there. Now, there's always a silver lining for each dark cloud, and sometimes you need to consciously force yourself to look for it. The same glass is either half empty or half full, depending on how you look at it, and you have to consciously decide which way you want to look at it. It would be nice to think that seeing it as half full just comes naturally. That's quite often not the case, though. You can use your language to help get you thinking about the positive aspect. Whatever situation presents itself, you notice that your first thought may be, the glass is half empty. So you have the opportunity then to consciously prompt yourself to think differently, to think about the other side of the picture by literally changing your words. In my case, I reframe my thinking by preceding the negative aspects of any situation with the words, what's bad about this situation is, and I'll recap because certainly you may see lots of bad things. And then immediately afterward, I force myself to say, and what's good about the situation is, and then I fill in the blanks. Now, I'm not saying it's always easy to see the half full view, but your words can help you find that silver lining. Force yourself to complete the sentence, even when the answer isn't obvious. What is good about the situation that just occurred? I just decided to have the carpeted floors in my home replaced with new hardwood floors. When the contractor arrived to deliver the oak boards, he backed right into my car. Was it there at the top of the driveway? He's got a truckload of wood. I heard the crunch and knew what had probably happened. Sure enough, the driver's side door was crushed in. And although the car was still drivable, I couldn't fully lower the window, and I knew that I'd be forced to hassle around, you know, find a body shop, deal with the insurance company. I hate all that stuff. At first, I looked at my car, and all I could see were the negatives. Then I consciously forced myself, after a few minutes, to fill in the blanks. What's good about this situation is... Now, I don't mean to tell you that it came naturally that I immediately started thinking, oh, here are the wonderful, great things. Before long, though, I was able to count on some positive benefits. I mean, for one, my negotiating position with the contractor was certainly strengthened at that point. For another, this incident reinforced my earlier decision to verify that the contractor did have valid insurance in place, and I'll make absolutely certain that I check out insurance with all future contractors. Now, the damage to my car also spurred me to take some overdue action. It was about time my wife had a new car of her own. She'd been driving mine, which is a sports car, and it's low, and it wasn't comfortable for her, and she didn't enjoy it. Plus, I tend to be disorganized and pretty messy, and she's exactly the opposite. Inevitably, the unkempt condition of my cars, which doesn't bother me at all, was a negative for her. So, because the contractor crunched the door of my car, I was motivated to go out car shopping for her. My sports car will be repaired at the contractor's insurance company's expense. My wife will get the new car she's been wanting all along. And I'll have the fun of driving a nice new rental car while mine is being repaired. Now, the net result of this is not that I'm glad my car got crunched. But it did get crunched. So, by taking stock of the situation in this matter, at least I felt a lot better. And my wife, by the way, chipped in that she's glad it happened, too. Hey, when an employee leaves you unexpectedly, or when a major account cancels a large order, or you sustain an injury, or something doesn't go quite the way you would have liked with your child, try forcing yourself to say, what's good about this situation is... and then fill in the blanks. No matter how bad things are, you can almost always find something positive to focus on. One of the most striking differences between winners and losers in life has to do with their visual focus. When things don't go quite right, losers say, "If only I had." In other words, they're looking over their shoulder at the past. Of course, they can't change the past or do anything about it, but still, they keep their gaze firmly focused behind them. Quite often, they're kicking themselves in the butt while they're doing so. Winners, on the other hand, do take a quick glance backward to notice what their personal responsibility was in the situation, and then they quickly turn their gaze forward. And rather than saying, "If only I had," they say, "Starting now, I will." Years ago, I was headed off to give a speech for a sales group and had prepared a PowerPoint show on my laptop. Just before the presentation was to begin, I set up the computer, plugged it into the projector, and as I did so, something didn't seem quite right. Partway through the presentation, everyone in the audience saw on the screen the words that no speaker ever wants to see come up. Preparing to hibernate. Sure enough, I'd left my power supply at home, and the computer had just enough juice to get me halfway through my speech. Now, I normally rely on visual aids to help me drive home my points and also to keep me on track so that I'm I don't want to be constantly looking at speaking notes, so my visuals help me too. In this instance, I got the opportunity to experience the freedom that comes with delivering a speech with no visual aids. My computer was dead. Since I was forced to do it, I just decided to enjoy it. Following the presentation, I did what most of us do, and I started saying to myself, if only I had remembered to pack that power supply. What's wrong with me? How could I have overlooked such an important detail? Then, though, I caught myself. I was focusing on the past and beating myself up, and that was going to do no good at all. So instead, I consciously made the decision to say to myself, starting now, I will always burn a CD with my PowerPoint presentation so that I could use someone else's computer if something went wrong with mine. And I will always have a written checklist to remind me of every last detail so that while packing for a speaking engagement, I can check them off one by one to make sure I'm not overlooking anything. Now, I have subsequently almost forgotten my power supply many times. Fortunately, that written list has saved me. And I've also experienced a complete computer failure and fortunately was able to proceed with my presentation because I had the backup disk to run on another computer. The point is simply this. Something bad happened. I have the choice to focus on what I didn't do in the past, or I can concentrate my attention on what I will do differently in the future. You can make that same choice. One of the most prevalent and effective schools of psychotherapy these days is referred to as cognitive restructuring. It has a lot to do with what this segment is all about. Cognition is the way you perceive things. Restructuring is changing it. Hey, things go wrong in life. Some people have an immediate tendency to generalize what's going wrong. If you listen carefully to their explanatory style, you'll hear them identify the current bad circumstances as part of a continuing trend with universal application in their life. Not only is this thing going badly, but everything is going badly. It's always that way. And losers go even further. They say, the reason things are always so bad in every area of my life is because I am bad. I'm a loser. Well, as you can imagine, that kind of language doesn't exactly help them pull themselves out of it. If that individual goes to visit a psychoanalyst who's schooled in cognitive restructuring therapy, the psychologist will help the patient more accurately describe the circumstances. Is it really true that everything is wrong in your life? Is nothing at all going right? Can you think of two or three things that are going well? Is it really always like this? Was there ever a time when things were going better for you? Can you imagine circumstances in which you might have things going better in the future? The psychologist's job is to help the patient put things in perspective. In effect, the psychologist wants the patient to recognize that this is an isolated incident and a recoverable situation. When things seem really awful in your life, if you don't have a handy psychoanalyst, you can start treating yourself. As soon as you notice yourself, start thinking, I'm a loser. Change your language. Consciously force yourself to say, I'm a winner who is currently experiencing negative results in one or two areas of my life. Remind yourself of what's going right and get into an action planning mode to free yourself from the paralysis that goes with telling yourself you're a loser. I'm sure you've noticed a lot of similarities in these most recent phrasing substitutions, and that's, of course, because they are all variations of the same basic idea. For some people, one verbal approach may make more sense or be easier to implement than another. The common theme here is that when things go wrong, winners recognize and affirm to themselves that even though things may seem bleak right now, they do possess the resiliency to make things better in the future. I have a good friend who's an inveterate entrepreneur. He's always coming up with some new idea for a business that sounds promising. And during the big dot-com craze, well, he came up with what seemed like a wonderful idea for an entirely new way to sell software. Microsoft and some other big software companies were impressed enough with his thinking that they signed agreements giving him the right to sell their software in this new way. This all looked very promising and exciting. It was so promising, in fact, that I decided to invest a substantial sum to help him start his new company. He even convinced his mother to invest her retirement funds in the company as well. And, of course, he let all of his closest friends in on the special first round of financing. My head was swimming with giant figures as I thought about how early investors in Microsoft and Google and so forth had they multiplied their initial investments by hundreds of times. Well, you guessed it. Things didn't work out that way. All the employees of the new company were laid off. My friend lost his home. And many of his friends lost significant investments, and that included me. My friend was definitely down in the dumps. The situation seemed bleak enough that I became concerned about his health and welfare. What he was saying was, "I'm going under. Everything's falling apart. I've lost my home, and now none of my friends will ever trust me again, not to mention my mom." Well, my friend's a very smart guy and a very resourceful person. It's certainly understandable that he would have been feeling down in the dumps at this point. But I counseled him to change what he was saying to himself. I insisted that he replace "I'm going under" with "I'm going to bounce back." Well, I hope you can guess the end of this story. Sure enough, my friend now has two very successful businesses. In fact, I wish I'd invested in them. No matter how bleak things may appear to you at any particular time, you can literally help yourself talk yourself out of it by changing your language. Dale Carnegie was certainly one of the most influential positive thinkers of the last century. You've certainly heard of and may have read his famous How to Win Friends and Influence People book, or perhaps The Power of Positive Thinking. Well, you may not have read one of his lesser-known books that's been a huge influence on my life. The book is titled How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. You can still find this book in most any bookstore. Even though it was written in the first part of the 20th century, its advice is as down-to-earth and practical today as it was then. It comes down to three simple steps. When you're worried about something going wrong, figure out what's the absolute worst that could happen. 2, accept it as if it has happened. And 3, now use the energy that you were expending beating yourself up and worrying to create a more positive outcome. This segment of our program has used many examples to emphasize the same point. Setbacks and failures in life are inevitable. When they happen, you have the choice to either view them as terminal situations from which you cannot recover, or you can see them as temporary setbacks which can yield extremely valuable lessons. The words you use to help shape your thinking and guide you out of that morass are simple. Substitute "here's what I learned" for "here's how I failed." Replace "if only I had" with "starting now, I will." Welcome your failures and setbacks. They present you the opportunities to learn the most poignant and valuable lessons in life. Always remember, every word matters.